Professor Shubar online with us right now this afternoon.
Yes, I am indeed. Indeed. Good afternoon, Simon.
I feel like I just played the correct color on the casino table and won. Great to have you, Prof.
Thank you very much.
Our subject today is, I believe, what the numbers and the models mean and tell us.
Yeah, I just got a message from the center that you also wanted to discuss. There was a publication this morning from, I think it was Daily Maverick or News 24, one of those two, about a bit of dissension in the ranks between the Ministerial Advisory Committee and the government.
Yes, very much.
Comments of Glenda Gray and so on.
Correct.
So shall maybe just quickly go through that before we get on to the main topic.
Wonderful. Your start, Prof. Start how you want.
Okie doke. Well, you know, first of all, I must say I can really only comment on what is being reported, what the News 24, Daily Maverick, what they report. And the reason why I'm saying is that, you know, I've had more than 40 years of dealing with the print media, and I'm not always totally satisfied with how accurate they report things. So I must start off with that proviso. I really comment on what has been published. Now, it would appear from the publication that the major complaint between the Ministerial Advisory Committee and the government is that the Advisory Committee's advice is not being taken, is not being listened to. I'm not sure I totally agree with, in fact, if that is the case, because I think it's a bit of hubris. You know, an advisory body is ready to provide advice. It doesn't necessarily mean that the government is obliged to execute that advice. So, at any event, some members of the advisory committee, in fact, the overall head, Professor Slim Karim, in fact, said it's not true. It's not true that the government has ignored their advice. But be that as it may, I think they would not, you know, there are certainly a number of members of the advisory committee who do feel quite strongly that the government is not going along the right path. But somewhat has been reported is actually a little bit puzzling, because Glenda Gray, I think is the main subject of the criticism. She's supposed to have said that the lockdown should be totally eradicated and that non-pharmaceutical intervention should be instituted instead. Hand washing, wearing more social distancing, prohibition on gatherings and so on. But that is in fact part of the lockdown. It's just a lower level. So I'm not quite sure what actually they say she's getting at in terms of that. And then importantly that the month-to-month phasing out of the lockdown has no basis in science. She's reported to have said, in fact, that the government is implementing rubbish, quite frankly. That's quite strong words.
She did say that.
But if she did, again, I don't quite understand that, because certainly it's international practice to phase out over a period of time, not suddenly, to abolish the lockdown. In fact, the United Nations head has kind of supported the government, in fact, in doing that. You know, there was another article came out from, I think it was Daily Maverick, so the United Nations has said President Cyril Ramaphosa is fighting the spread, I'm just reading it out, with strong and necessary measures. So he's in support of it. Also Tony Fauci, who I've got a lot of respect for, you know, the main advisor to the President of the United States, is also kind of in favor of a gradual lifting and wary of not lifting it too suddenly because we might have a resurgence. So, you know, these are all things which I'm not quite sure what the people who are objecting to the government policy are really getting at. You know, it could be certainly that the kind of minutiae are puzzling. You know, the hot food, I think we dealt with in a previous session. The clothing restrictions.
Sure. Exercise for three hours in the day.
But those are minutiae. I don't think those are the kind of main issues. There's another thing which Glenda is reported to have said is that the strategy is, it's not based in science. And she's saying that the vulnerable are really only the elderly and those with comorbidities. People under 30 and school-going children are not. And therefore, what she's saying, you should deal with those people and not the people who are not at risk. The only problem with that logic is that, of course, it is the young adults who actually spread the infection to the people that are vulnerable. So you do have to deal with them. You can't not deal with them. You can't have two kind of strategies because they are interdependent on each other.
Professor Barry Shoup, the former executive director of the National Institute for Communicable Diseases. Prof, just I don't want to let it go, the issue we were talking about in the last 5 minutes. You said something yesterday that's just resonated and struck with me for the past 24 hours. You said that empirical evidence proved that in the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic, those cities that closed down recovered more quickly. And I think that is just such an important statistic that nobody is talking about because it just probably doesn't suit their agenda.
Yeah, in fact, the United Nations head, which I mentioned earlier on, he actually emphasized that point. He said that if they do control COVID correctly, the economic revival will be much quicker than if they don't, than if there's incomplete control of the pandemic.
Yeah, I hear you loud and clear. It's hard to see that now. It's hard to see it 5 weeks into a lockdown. But if that's what the empirical evidence shows, then, you know, far be it from us to argue. Prof,
the other worrying thing about this, of course, is the effect on non-COVID diseases. And in that article, in fact, Glenda did make mention that they are now again seeing malnutrition, acute malnutrition at Barry Gwynedd Hospital. And Ian Zanner said that there are now 40 to 60% down on people coming for HIV medication, diabetes medication, and so on. Childhood vaccination, sorry. So these are very serious considerations which also have to come into the equation. I also want to talk mainly what I think has also caused a lot of confusion in people is how severe is it really? You know, we're getting people that are kind of number crunching, and out of number crunching, they're kind of saying, well, it's not quite as severe. It may be just a bad flu and so on. So I just go through very quickly how accurate are these figures and what do these figures really mean? First of all, those figures which are fairly reliable are those which come from the fact that the disease is a notifiable disease. So the number of deaths is probably pretty precise, and the number of cases that are seen in the healthcare profession, in hospitals and clinics and so on, that's pretty precise. So from that one can work out the population mortality. I think I mentioned some of that last time or yesterday. The mortality, for example, in Israel is 30.5 per million population, as against, for example, the United Kingdom is 518 per million.
What a statistic.
So you can kind of compare things in terms of population mortality, also case fatality, the number of people that die divided by the number of people who come to the hospital and so on. That's the case fatality. And again, it's a measure of how well people are being treated. Those are pretty accurate figures. What we don't know, and what we would really dearly like to know, is in fact the bottom of the iceberg. What we're seeing, people that come toward medical treatment, just the tip of the iceberg. How big is the bottom of the iceberg? People that are either that don't come for treatment, either they don't have symptoms, or they're very mild symptoms which they dismiss. And that's, of course, a very important parameter. How extensive is the epidemic? And we can measure it in one of two ways. Either we can actually test for people that are infected who are not patients. And that's a major public health exercise that is being done at the moment. Close to 500,000 tests have been carried out by community health workers going out into the community. The problem with that is that it is subject to how good you take a specimen, you know, it's a throat swab or a nasal swab. Is it taken properly? And also the other problem is that you can only diagnose in a very narrow period of when people are infected. So what really rely on is what's called seroprevalence. I think you asked me that about a week ago. In other words, we measure what is the prevalence of people's antibodies. Now, antibodies you develop later in the infection and is supposed to last for a period of time. But as Donald Rumsfeld, you remember Donald Rumsfeld was a Secretary of State in America. I just want to quote what he said. As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know that there's some things we don't know.
Okay.
in the seroprevalence stage, there are a lot of things we don't know. How long the antibodies last for? Does everybody develop antibodies? And also, what does it mean? Does it mean that they're immune? Because we need to know this too, if we're going to establish what herd immunity level we need to reach before the virus disappears. Another unknown, of course, is the accuracy of the test itself. There's a saying, it's called the Wittgenstein's ruler. That's the problem of measuring the instrument by measuring what it tries to measure.
Oh, my goodness.
So two unknowns. We don't know about the antibody.
Oh, my goodness.
And we don't know how accurate the test is. So not surprisingly, there's a wide variety of results. So, for example, in Spain, it's 5% of the population with antibodies. France, 4%. Los Angeles is 4.6%. And this is way below what we need to get to for herd immunity, which is, what, 60 to 70%. So even in those countries which have had a mature outbreak, it's still way below what we need for population immunity. So that's also something which causes confusion. If you've got time, I can also talk about another problem.
Prof, can I ask you to address that issue tomorrow?
I will do, certainly.
We're out of time, but I could listen to you all day on this stuff.
Yeah, I'm talking too much, am I?
No. It's fascinating and it's well worthwhile, but I'm just going to take you in little doses. So tomorrow you'll come back with that. And as always, Prof, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam. Thanks for having me.